Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judakin. With me today is local Memphis writer Preston Lauterbach. Prior to his first book, Preston was a roving rock and music reporter for Living Blues and local favorites Memphis Flyer and Memphis Magazine. The Chitlin' Circuit and the Road to Rock and Roll is his first monograph. On October 27th and 28th, Preston will be the keynote speaker for a series of events about the Chitlin' Circuit, co-sponsored by the Marcus W. Orr Center for the Humanities at University of Memphis and the Mike Kerb Institute for Music at Rhodes College. Preston, it's good to have you on Counterpoint.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Preston, your book is about the thriving African-American subculture that few outsiders know much about that was dubbed the Chitlin' Circuit. What was, and still is, in fact, the Chitlin' Circuit, and how did these clubs and juke joints and other musical backrooms come to be named for this Southern culinary delicacy?
The first part of the answer would be that it is the route of black nightclubs, concentrated most heavily in the Deep South, but also up through Midwestern cities, up the Eastern Seaboard, and out to the West Coast. But it is an African-American subculture, black entertainers, black audience, black business people, which is partially why it is not as well known in the mainstream, simply that it was this really self-sufficient subculture that took care of its own business, you know, whether it be through developing its own media contacts, developing its own styles of entertainment. It really was and is something that took care of itself without a lot of need for outside attention. How it got the name is a little bit more of a mysterious answer, I think, because there isn't any clearly documented instance of the circuit being named. There was no board meeting of nightclub owners and hustlers in 1928 when they came up with it, because the enterprise operated informally, very holistically, but still informally. So the chitlin is the intestine of a hog. That is the vernacular name for that particular cuisine, I think is what you called it.
Can't say it sounds delicious, but...
Well, I haven't sampled them myself. That was not part of my research. It's a part of that spoken word culture, which has its own vocabulary, its own glossary, its own way of naming and talking about things. So even before, or contemporary to the Chitlin' Circuit coming together, which would be the 1930s and the 1940s, there was a popular song called Chitlin' Switch, which referred basically to your average Southern town, you know, which was where the Chitlin' Circuit thrived. There was a dance popular in South Carolina in the 20s called the Chitlin' Strut. Before that, here, W.C. Handy, in writing a song called Beale Street Blues, sang about Chitlin' cafes in the 19-teens. So it's been a prevalent part of black entertainment culture going back to the early part of the 20th century. How the circuit became known by that particular name, my theory is that it's the same way that everybody on the street had nicknames. So it's sort of a loving but honestly joking way of saying this cycle of clubs is as mainstream entertainment as the chitlin is to the ham. You know, it's making do with what's left after the finer cuts are gone.
Now, the big arc of the musical history you tell takes the reader from Dixie and swing music to the early roots of rock and roll via the routes that blues music traveled. Can you give us the big overview on how these transformations came about before we get into some of the details of the story?
Yeah, sure. In the 30s, the key figure in virtually all of black music and entertainment was Duke Ellington, swing band leader. So his style of music was based on an orchestral model, 18, 20 pieces, reed section, horn section. Sometimes some of these types of acts that were patterned along the Ellington model would have a glee club, you know, singers, or a dance troupe, floor show that went along with it. But the basic musical component was that big band style. And so everything that played on the circuit in the 30s followed that particular model. So the popular acts in the 30s were like the Earl Hines Orchestra, Walter Barnes Orchestra, which is not as well known but was very popular among black audiences in the 1930s. In the 1940s, the new trend came along via an artist by the name of Louis Jordan, who's from across the river in Brinkley, Arkansas. But different, a real turn from the big band style, Louis Jordan had a band called the Timpani Five, five pieces, so it was a small combo. Audiences on the Chitlin' Circuit dug this because it was new, it was fresh. You know, they'd been in the big band bag for decades, and so this was different. It was a small combo making big noise and in a very different style. the business people on the circuit who are ultimately in charge of what is popular and what the people see loved it because overhead for a small band, for a five-piece, is, two-thirds less than overhead would be for a 15-piece. So that savings was significant, and it was important to the people who were in the music business and the music industry and making the decisions about what was going to be popular and what was going to be showcased. The people, in addition to digging the new trend, they liked the lower ticket prices, so it really worked. The small band transformation that Louis Jordan started in early part of World War II fit in with what was going on economically and culturally at that time.
And there, part of what you talk about is the fact that there was this huge infusion of money into the black community as a result of the war effort and the economic incentives behind that and the jobs that were there. And that really dried up in the immediate post-war period, right? So you had to shift towards a less expensive way of making music.
Absolutely. It was a real boom and bust period in black America because the war created almost total employment in black America for the first time in American history. But the end of the war resulted in practically the opposite. All those defense industry jobs dried up. In the meantime, nightclubs had opened up in unprecedented numbers all across the map. And because of racial segregation, the American policy in effect at that time, there was black nightclubs, there was white nightclubs. But on the Chitlin circuit, it was all black. So what worked for the black economy as a whole reflected on the entertainment business. So all these nightclubs opened up during the war when there's a great deal of prosperity. When that prosperity vanished after the war, these clubs needed to do something to stay open. And so they took to showcasing cheaper, smaller bands. And this, you know, ended up spreading the seeds of rock and roll music because, as you know, the basic elements of rock and roll, a small band with a vocalist out in front and a few pieces making a lot of noise.
Now, one of the big points that you hammer home in the book is that rock and roll really was invented by black musicians traveling the roads of the Chitlin Circuit. And this black music was later picked up by white musicians who sold it to white audiences in a Jim Crow America. Here's how you put it in one passage. The standardized definitions of rock and roll, courtesy of institutions such as the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Rolling Stone magazine, emphasize a fusion of black rhythm and blues and white country and western sounds, as if the two styles brought distinct elements to a new mixture. While that certainly applies to Bill Haley and Elvis Presley, some of the first rock and roll stars as such, it implies a shared primacy that simply didn't exist at the true dawn of rock and roll. While black music was clearly rockin' by 1949, country and western fans delighted to the sounds of yodels, waltzes, accordions, fiddles, and steel guitars. Great stuff, but not the stuff of rock and roll. Will you pick up on this thread in your book?
Well, I agree with me wholeheartedly. Well, what aspect of it would you want me to address?
Well, just the idea that, in fact, rock and roll, which in Memphis in particular, we still tend to celebrate so much around what ends up happening at Sun Records
Elvis is an excellent starting point for this. So he's, you know, considered, if not the father of rock and roll, the king of rock and roll. But a lot of the songs that he first recorded were simply covers of black songs that had been in circulation, in some cases, for like two decades. One instance that was really exciting to me as it revealed itself in my research was a song, That's All Right, Mama. Very first single that Elvis recorded that broke him out on the scene. And it's fairly well known that that's a cover of a Big Boy Crudup song, who is a black artist. What I didn't know and what really just kind of hit me out of the blue was that basic lyric snatch, That's All Right, Mama, That's All Right for You, went back on the Chitlin circuit to the 30s. There was an artist by the name of Little Brother Montgomery who was based in a Jackson, Mississippi brothel, which is not unusual for a Chitlin circuit musician during this time period as those kinds of places were economically linked to the music that was being played. But in any case, one of the songs that he recorded in 1936 featured that exact same stanza that was the key stanza in That's All Right, Mama. A few years later, it was an artist by the name of Joe Turner who would become famous and really accepted as a rock and roll musician himself for songs like Shake, Rattle, and Roll. He recorded a version of that which featured the exact same stanza. A few years later, Louis Jordan, who is the one that I credit with really initiating that transformation from big band to small band, recorded a song featuring the same stanza, that That's All Right, Mama stanza. And so that was a folk song. That was some old stuff by the time that Elvis Presley recorded it and supposedly made it this explosive new American phenomenon, rock and roll.
What's your take on why the story about the centrality of black musicians in creating rock and roll isn't more well known?
Well, the gatekeepers of rock and roll history, the people that have written it and have circulated it, for the most part are, you know, white, liberal baby boomers. I think that to them, you know, they're the civil rights generation, the integration generation. To them, it was just so central to their identity to be accepting of black culture. I'm sure that they had the best intentions by including black artists in that, you know, fusion of country and western and rhythm and blues, which supposedly equaled rock and roll. The truth is that all of the basic elements of rock and roll existed in black music before that fusion took place. Why that particular fact is overlooked is a bit of a mystery to me. But that's my theory. I think it's a generational bias, more or less, on who has written rock and roll history.
Now, in the pages of your book, one reads a whole number of wonderful vignettes about a number of these musicians, Walter Barnes, Louis Jordan, B.B. King, Little Richard, James Brown, Ike Turner, and there are many others. However, the real protagonists of this story are a set of African-American promoters and entrepreneurs, who some might even dub black gangsters or hustlers if they wanted to denigrate their accomplishments. But this is really a book about black businessmen triumphing in the face of great adversity with a musical soundtrack as a backdrop. Why do you think it's so important to tell the stories of Denver Ferguson and Don Roby and Sunbeam Mitchell and their ilk?
Well, those really kingpins was the preferred terminology back during that time frame. Incidentally, I don't think it denigrates them at all to call them hustlers. You know, I think that they would have been okay with that terminology. But you're right; it does lend a certain air of immorality to their accomplishments, and it's quite true when you think about the immoral world that they were working in and the evil system that they were working in spite of. You really have to take whatever their immoral activities were with a little bit of a grain of salt. But they made a lot of decisions about how the music sounded. As I said earlier, these kingpins were the ones that were the gatekeepers on the Chitlin' circuit. They decided who was going to go on stage. So in the most basic fundamental sense, they controlled what the people were going to hear. That was in the case of artists who had already arrived, who had had an important record out, had made some other appearances and displayed some kind of commercial potential and were worth the risk of putting out there. On a more grassroots level, these kingpins developed new talent. And so that was really key, too. You would not have Little Richard or James Brown, I mean, two of the pillars that American culture rests on, if there was no Clint Brantley, who was the kingpin of Macon, Georgia, that both of those giants came out of, who cultivated both of these terrific artists and got them ready for stardom.
Let's talk a little bit more about some of these kingpins. The Chitlin' Circuit was first put together by Denver Ferguson. Tell us a little more about the Ferguson brothers and how the Chitlin' Circuit came about under their direction.
Denver Ferguson and his brother C. Ferguson were based in Indianapolis, Indiana. So if you'd told me 7 years ago when I started researching this thing that the Chitlin' Circuit began in Indianapolis, I would have looked at you like you were nuts. There were so many surprises that ended up coming out of the research for this. But Denver and C. were educated, smart, visionary. They knew how to make money. They understood the way that business really functioned in segregated environments. So like in Indianapolis, there was one black main street, similar to Beale Street here in Memphis that everybody can relate to. There were Beale Streets all over the map. And that's what the Chitlin' Circuit really ran through. But in Indianapolis, it was called Indiana Avenue. What they did that was so brilliant, the foundation of their wealth was a numbers game, which is played just like people play the lottery today, only it was conducted illegally and before lotteries were conducted in a mainstream way. It was a street lottery. So they had collectors going around taking people's bets and taking people's money, and then they would pay off whatever numbers happened to hit through a drawing. Well, they made an awful lot of money at this. And from there, transitioned into the nightclub business. And I suppose learned some of the ins and outs of the nightclub business by being talent buyers. But they were also from the Deep South, or not from the Deep South, from the Black South. So they knew how segregation created these streets, these main streets, all across the map. I mean, from Memphis to Miami, Los Angeles, Oakland, that they were all over the place. And they had this vision. They understood that there was collective wealth out there, if not individual wealth. That's the financial principle of the numbers game. You got a lot of poor people in a really tight area. It's worth it to them to throw a couple pennies down in hopes of winning a few dollars. And those pennies add up every single day. Same economic principle was how the Chitlin Circuit was envisioned. The Ferguson brothers knew that there were people out there in the across the map who were hungry for entertainment, who weren't being served by the mainstream. And so they came upon a system where first they had about a dozen bands that I think they probably had gotten to know through booking them at their own nightclubs. And then they developed this route of promoters really brilliantly. They understood that in these black enclaves, everybody went to the barber shop, everybody went to the cafe, everybody went to the bar. They didn't have a lot of options for getting around. And so it was pretty simple to advertise and to reach the clientele when you're just trying to hit them on one street. But they took barbers and made them promoters, taught them how to advertise the shows, taught them how to take money for the tickets and send some back to the agency in Indianapolis. And if you put that together, you know, string it across the map, that is what became the Chitlin Circuit. Denver Ferguson collected phone books. Myself, in studying the nightclub business in the 30s, they just had all the clubs, all the black clubs basically had one in a handful of names. The Cotton Club, again, because of that pervasive Duke Ellington influence. The Harlem Club, Lenox Club. So Ferguson, back during that time period, collected phone books from every southern town. And if there was any kind of place called the Cotton Club or called the Harlem Inn, Harlem Grill, he knew this is going to be on the circuit. You know, he knew that it was a black hub.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judakin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. With me today is Preston Lauterbach, whose book about the Chitlin Circuit will be featured at a two-day celebration of the Chitlin Circuit on October 27th and 28th, co-sponsored by the Marcus Orr Center for the Humanities at University of Memphis and the Mike Kerb Institute for Music at Rhodes College. Check out their websites for the full lineup of events. Now, Preston, a solid swath of the story is centered in Memphis, which was a key nodal point on the map you recreate. There was a whole number of factors that made Memphis important. Here's something you write. Whatever explanations exist for Memphis producing so many more black musicians between the 1930s and 1960s than other southern cities with sizable black populations did, indeed for a multi-million-dollar music industry developing in the city, largely around homegrown African-American musicians, they began with Lunsford's introduction of music education to Memphis's black public schools. Can you start a little bit with Jimmy Lunsford and with the music education in public schools and take it from there to give us some of the factors that make Memphis such an important hub of American music?
The foundation of it is with music education in the black schools. In 1924, that didn't exist here. There was no kind of program for educating black students in music. 1925, Jimmy Lunsford graduated from Fisk University over in Nashville and got a job here at Manassas High School in North Memphis, teaching English, Spanish, coaching athletics, still no band. So on his own, through his own motives and with his own fundraising, he created this program at Manassas High School for teaching students music. He built an orchestra there. So he left Memphis, but that program that he installed at Manassas stayed. And whether at Manassas or Booker T. Washington or later Melrose High School, the black high schools created and nurtured so much of the great musical talent that Memphis is known for, from Booker T. Jones to a lot of the jazz men that came out of Manassas. Isaac Hayes is a Manassas student who learned some chops there. In fact, the leader of what was for a time the house band at Motown Records, if you can believe that, got his chops at, I think, Booker T. Washington. That was Pistol Allen.
And then what were some of the other central vehicles for nurturing the musical talent that was here that came about over, let's say, between the 30s and 40s in this period?
The only other part of the equation that is required is finding work. And so that's what it was. There was a lot of work here for musicians, thanks to the club scene. For a while on Beale Street, though that was closed down in 1940 by Mayor Crump, reopened after World War II, thanks to a fellow by the name of Andrew Sunby Mitchell, who you alluded to earlier, who would be one of this class of kingpins that was so crucial to the Chitlin Circuit. He developed, in a way that is still a mystery to me, a partnership with a very powerful Memphian by the name of Abe Plow, who in 1945 was not only one of the richest men in the Mid-South, was one of the richest men in the country, having gone from being a successful cosmetics executive and company owner, multimillionaire, who was based here in Memphis still after striking it rich and successful. How Sunbeam attracted him into the situation, I'm afraid we're never going to know, though the possibilities sure are enticing. But with Mr. Plow's protection, Sunbeam Mitchell was allowed to operate despite the Crump machine having slowed all of that underworld and nightclub activity down. Great blues musicians like B.B. King.
It's also interesting, I have to say, this relationship between blacks and Jews that you talked about. It's not only the relationship between Sunbeam Mitchell and Abe Plow. I mean, that was another interesting part of the story, but I'll just refer readers to the book to find out some of the others. By the middle of the 1950s, around the same time as Brown v. Board of Education, black rock and roll really went mainstream and was crossing over for both white and black performers. And soon the record industry and DJs had a bigger role than agents, promoters, and club owners. This was the turning point for the Chitlin Circuit, wasn't it? And what do you think were the factors, aside from this, that ended up leading to the decline of the Chitlin Circuit?
Black artists didn't make money off of records. It just wasn't the way the system was set up. They made records. The idea behind records was that they would promote their next gig. So records were seen as promotional tours. They made their money on the road, on the circuit, which is why the Chitlin Circuit was so key to any kind of development in the music. That's just where things happen. Innovation followed the money, just like it does almost everywhere else. When that money started to come out of the recording studio more than the nightclub, it was one of those fundamental, small but fundamental shifts that changed everything in the business. So, for instance, in 1946, just to throw a year out there, there would be no incentive, there would be no reason for someone who was producing black records to have like a house band. Stax Records and High Records, both in South Memphis, were built on steady, versatile house bands who were there in the record studio, who really defined the sound and defined the product. There just wasn't any economic incentive to work the business like that in the 40s. But once a Memphis artist by the name of Johnny Ace killed himself accidentally on Christmas night in 1954, and that story and his music, for whatever reason, was a big draw for white listeners. More and more white DJs are playing black music, and more white teenagers are listening to it and hearing it. If you think about, well, again, another snapshot in time. In 1946, there wasn't black radio. That, of course, started here as well with WDIA in 47, 48. So there just wasn't an opportunity. Racial segregation was such that not very many white people had access to Chitlin Circuit music. But by the time DJs are playing it and broadcasting it and black music is more prevalently available on the airwaves, there's no way to segregate, you know, a white teenager's radio listening habits. I'm sure that some parents tried, but it's much harder to do than keeping them off of Beale Street, right? So that was really a agent for major change. All of those things just coming together. It seems like anarchy, but it's pretty simple when you think about it.
And if that was at least the tipping point, then it seems to be the case in your book that you argue that really what ended up, you know, wiping away the Chitlin Circuit, at least for some time, was urban renewal. And you quote James Baldwin as saying, urban renewal was really Negro removal.
That's right.
And that marked the decay of the Chitlin Circuit because ultimately the infrastructure was wiped away. Tell us a little of that story.
Right. That, you know, urban renewal programs began coincidentally right at the same time period in the mid-50s that this black music started to reach over across the tracks into the white mainstream. I don't think that there's a correlation necessarily, but it's certainly interesting that those two events ran along the same timeline. But urban renewal, Negro removal, whatever you want to call it, it's the same thing. It was a federal government sponsored plan. They called it slum clearance in some cases to improve black sections of cities. And we have a great example here with the Beale Street area. So Beale Street was the heart. There was not only Beale Street, but there was an entire district around it.
Now, the Chitlin Circuit's far from gone, though. I mean, and the king of the Chitlin Circuit, Bobby Rush, is not only going to be on the panel of Chitlin Circuit musicians who will talk about their experiences at 3 o'clock at Rhodes College McCallum Ballroom in the Bryan Campus Life Center that you're moderating, Preston, but he continues to perform, and he will be performing in concert that night in downtown. So what is the Chitlin Circuit like today?
You know, it's working class people. The musicians, the entertainers are, like Bobby Rush is, depending on what kind of mood he's in, 68, 73, or 78 years old. The other entertainers, you know, are they're not glamorous. They're just regular people. They're talented, right? But, I mean, they look like the audience. So there's a correlation there. But it is, they sing songs about middle-aged black romance gone wrong, and the crowd relates to it. Everybody dances and has a great time.
Preston, I love the voice of your book. You write in a kind of a Hepcat tone, almost borrowed from another era. The book reads to me less like a work of history or rock reportage than it does like a 1930s or 1940s Pulp Fiction detective story. Was this a voice that emerged from the archive that you were trolling? Because you oftentimes do echo the reporters from the black press that you often cite. Or is this just really the tone of your authorial voice?
No, it's very much a product of me being immersed in these sources for so long and just being able to hear them. I felt like while I was reading these old newspaper accounts of, you know, gigs at these colorfully named nightclubs, beautifully decorated nightclubs, I felt like I was there, and I want to convey as much of that sense to the reader as possible. You know, I want the reader to be able to smell the smoke and have to dodge the switchblade and everything else, you know, that I experienced when I was going through all of this material. But I found that style, you call it Hepcat, to be just very appealing. So it's a little bit more in step with what the material and what this culture and what the vibe really was all about than my voice. Like, I'm writing a book now that's set in the 19th century, and, you know, there's not a lot of Hepcat lingo in there.
To hear the voice of Preston Lauterbach live and direct discussing the Chitlin Circuit and the road to rock and roll, join us on October 27th at University of Memphis in the University Center Auditorium, starting at 6 o'clock, and then again on the 28th at 1 p.m. at Rhodes College McCallum Ballroom in the Bryan Campus Life Center for the start of the Chitlin Circuit Symposium, where there will be presentations on Southern music, followed by a roundtable discussion with Bobby Rush and, among others, Emerson Abel, the man who kicked Isaac Hayes out of the high school band, and other veterans of the Chitlin Circuit at 3 p.m., capped off that evening with a concert downtown featuring Bobby Rush and the Bow Keys. Preston, thanks so much for being here with us today.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it, and I hope to see everybody at the Chitlin Circuit Symposium.
To replay this interview or to listen to other Counterpoint interviews, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the link View All Podcasts and RSS Feeds, where you can also leave feedback about the show. Counterpoint is also now available for podcasting on iTunes. Just visit the iTunes store and search for Jonathan Judaikin or Counterpoint and sign up to receive the podcast as a regular download. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Thanks for listening.